Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi everyone, welcome to a very special show. Originally we were going to be at 12 o'clock with a couple of guests, but they have got COVID-19, which I'm sure many of you looking around your friendship groups, people at work, there's a pretty similar pattern at the moment. Now, it's nearly 2 years since a cluster of unexplained pneumonia cases was identified in Wuhan province in China. Since then, the virus identified a secure acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2, which we have all come to know as COVID, has officially killed over 5 million people globally. That's likely to be a drastic underestimate. According to The Economist, which has been tracking excess deaths, the most reliable indicator of how many people have died, around 18.2 million are likely to have died in less than 2 years of the biggest public health emergency since the Spanish flu, up to 21.3 million, a death toll comparable to that of World War I, which was spread over 4 years. Now, it's a year since mass vaccination began, yet here we are all over again, talking about potential severe restrictions. Already, Netherlands has gone into a harsh lockdown. That's thanks to Omicron. Now, except for aficionados of the Greek alphabet, that was not something we were talking about until about 3 weeks ago, and yet it's now the dominant strain here in the United Kingdom. So how bad is Omicron? What is the data telling us? Illness, hospitalization, death. What do we know from data abroad? And what do we think this means for the for our current situation, for the National Health Service, and how we ever escape this? Now, but to just to we're going to be joined now by the fantastic John Byrne Murdoch at the Financial Times, who has really been a lifeline for myself and so many others, the data, his data crunching, his analysis, all the way through lockdown. I'll just bring in John straight away. John, thanks for joining us, not least during all of this.
No,
you're doing well, hopefully so far.
I've somehow remained COVID-free for the whole 2 years, as far as I know. So,
blimey. Yeah I got hit on so-called Freedom Day. So there we have
right.
Look, I'll just start just quickly. That, again, it's a big honour to join us. And for those who aren't familiar with John, I'd be surprised anyone who's been following COVID particularly carefully that you haven't seen his brilliant work in the Financial Times and on social media. Let me just... Here's a little clip from Chris Whitty last week.
There are several things we don't know, but all the things that we do know are bad.
Does that still hold?
Good question. I think a lot of people sort of liked Whitty's phrasing there, but I think it's tricky. We do know, I'd say we know some things which are not necessarily terrible. One of those is that we're starting to get early confirmation from the UK of a pattern we saw in South Africa, which is that a larger portion of COVID patients being admitted to hospitals with Omicron than compared to previous variants are actually not being treated for COVID. They were admitted for some other reason. So there is this confirmation that we're maybe starting to see, well, essentially because the Omicron variant spreads so efficiently, if we look only at, for example, the numbers of people in hospital who've tested positive for COVID, in this wave, that's probably actually slightly going to overstate the level of pressure the NHS is coming under, because more of those are going to be people who went to hospital for other reasons and then incidentally tested positive. So that's one thing. The other is there was this study out of South Africa done by a private healthcare organisation over there last week, which did suggest that even after they attempted to adjust for whether or not people were vaccinated, whether or not people had had COVID-19 before, it did look as though the severity of disease from the Omicron variant could be modestly lower than what we'd seen with previous variants. Again, not by a huge amount, and that result was very preliminary, but I would say there are a couple of pieces of not cast iron evidence, but pieces of information from the scientific community which suggest that there is, I would say, genuine reason to be optimistic that this might not be quite as bad as what has come before it. But the majority of evidence we have seen doesn't point in that direction. So there's evidence pointing both ways, or indeed a lack of evidence. But I think there are a couple of bits that we can be hopeful about.
So in terms of this drastic rise of Omicron, here's a graph which was shared by Dr. Theo Sanderson, which I saw you shared on your own social media accounts. So this is Delta. For those listening on the podcast, we're showing a graph of Delta, which is around 3,000 to 4,000 cases a day, going up and down, and then suddenly Omicron suddenly explodes. So I suppose the question, when there's a lot of conversation at the moment about, is this intrinsically milder, which, and because kind of colliding with a different conversation of, given the level of people who've been infected with previous variants, myself, I'm likely to have got Delta, in terms of, vaccination, in terms of obviously different levels of protection that might afford as well, in terms of the booster program, which has been rolled out very quickly now, and how long it takes for the booster to be effective. What's your take on that debate in terms of, and obviously bearing in mind we've only had this variant for just over 3 weeks, so this is still very much lots of unknowns, but in terms of the kind of what we know so far, in terms of inherently is it milder, and those other variables about vaccination, boosters and prior infection?
Yeah, it's such an important question, because something I found myself replying to a lot of people on Twitter about on Friday over and over again was this idea that people look at the data from South Africa, which has been very promising. It's shown that if you compare it to South Africa's Delta wave, the percentage of cases ending up in hospitalization or indeed death is much lower than was seen with the Delta wave. So people look at that, and even after adjusting for age, for example, the share of COVID positive patients in hospitals in South Africa who lose their lives is much lower than we'd seen in previous waves. So people look at that and say, okay, well, that looks like the Omicron variant is milder. It's less severe, because for the same number of cases, you get fewer people developing severe disease or dying. And that is all true. But the big question is, where is that mildness coming from? Because the thing that I've found a little bit frustrating over the last 3 weeks is that we saw exactly the same thing happen when Delta landed in the UK late May, early June of this year, which is we saw a lot of cases, but because of the vaccination campaign, primarily, some of this was due to protection among people who'd been infected previously, but most of it was from the vaccination campaign. Because of that, we also saw in the UK a much lower percentage of cases developing into severe disease, hospitalization and death. But at the time, of course, no one was saying, oh, it looks like Delta's milder. We were saying, look at the impact of vaccines, look at the impact of immunity. So this is the thing that irks me a little bit, because we're now seeing a broadly similar pattern play out in South Africa. Now, it's true that the extent of the reduction in severe disease in South Africa is a bigger reduction in extent than we saw in the UK from vaccination alone. But we're still seeing broadly the same pattern. And so when people say, okay, well, I guess we can expect that same thing to happen here in the UK, which is that although cases are going to go up a lot at the moment, hospitalizations and deaths won't. Now, that kind of assumes that since June, July, since Delta landed in the UK, we've had another big boost in immunity. And although, of course, that's true to an extent, we've had the boosters, what we don't know is whether the boosters, compared to in many cases 6 months old second doses, we don't know whether the boosters are giving us sort of extra protection from what we had against Delta, or whether they essentially take us back to where we were 6 months ago with Delta. And that really matters, because with cases now going well above what we'd seen at any point in the pandemic previously, it's really important whether we're saying that, okay, like with Delta, maybe we'll see about 2% of those cases end up in hospital. Because if that's true, then a huge rise in cases still produces a very, very large number of hospitalizations, perhaps as many as we saw last winter. Or are we saying that for some other reasons, perhaps boosters, but also perhaps a reduction in the actual severity of the Omicron variant, instead of seeing 2% of cases end up requiring treatment in hospital, now perhaps we'll only see 1% or 0.5%. And that's what we just don't know yet, because in South Africa, while we can say their outcomes have improved, we can't tell how much of that is to do with immunity, with vaccination, with prior infection, and how much is to do with an innate drop in severity. So that's why we're still seeing these models come out which forecast potentially quite dire outcomes. And we just don't have enough information yet on what the UK's immunity wall, as it were, looks like in terms of how that's evolved over the last 6 months, and whether Omicron is going to turn out to just be less virulent for any given person, full stop.
I mean, do you think the problem in terms of the comparisons with South Africa, and at the moment there does seem to be cautious cause for optimism based on the data we've got, is South Africa has actually been exceptionally badly hit by COVID in a way that I don't think people really appreciate, because its official deaths are around 90,000, which is bad enough, but that's such a drastic underestimate. Our excess deaths and our official deaths are actually not that badly unaligned anymore, are they? But in South Africa, up to 300,000, slightly less than 300,000 people are estimated as excess deaths. South Africa's population is slightly lower than ours. It's about 60 million compared to about 66, 67 million people were here. So their excess death toll has been twice as high on a slightly smaller population. Does that mean basically far more people statistically got COVID in South Africa? They also have a younger population. They have less older people. So what we've seen is Omicron go through a population which actually has already lots of people, to be really macabre, who are likely to succumb to COVID, have already died in a way that isn't the case here in Britain. What do you think?
That's definitely, I think, certainly aspects of that are true. So it's absolutely right. The estimates of seroprevalence, so the percentage of people in South Africa who are believed to have had COVID in the past, estimates of that coming into the Omicron wave, so before Omicron, put the figure at around 80% of people in the country, so 80%, 80%, who had had COVID in the past and recovered. In the UK, like today, that figure is probably around 40%, but before our Delta wave, at least, it was closer to, I think, 20%. So going into their Omicron wave, far, far more of the South African population had been exposed to the virus, which means they had some level of immunity than we had coming into our Delta wave. So, and look, there's another way that some people have pointed this out as well, which is that after the Delta wave in South Africa, which was extremely severe, their case numbers had got exceptionally, exceptionally low. I think lower than at any point in the entire pandemic over there, which is a very good sign that there was enough immunity circulating that the virus was just finding it very difficult to find new people to infect. Whereas in the UK, Delta has been bubbling along here at moderately high case levels since June. So that alone suggests that there was, in terms of immunity from infection, there was arguably more of that in South Africa than we've had here, which is why, as you say, a very large portion of their observed reduction in severe disease could be due to that. But there's a couple of other things you mentioned there. So one is this idea that the population that is left over, as it were, are those who are likely to be more able at standing up against COVID. And that is true. But I think that is also true in the UK. Again, it's true that more people in South Africa have been infected with this in the past, but certainly, again, in that sort of slightly macabre way of talking about it, a lot of people in the UK who were most vulnerable to this lost their lives in either March, April 2020 or December, January last year, which does mean that we also have this, the surviving population, as it were, in the UK is now going to be better able to fight COVID than was the case a year or 6 months ago. But the other thing that we don't fully know yet is how this how the impact of immunity affects severe disease relative to infection. So we know that protection against severe disease is much more long lasting than protection against infection. But what we don't know is exactly how those two play out with Omicron. So it could be, for example, that although a smaller percentage of the population in the UK has been infected than in South Africa, it could be that the very, very large numbers in the UK who've had one, two, or indeed three vaccinations means that we now have exceptionally high protection against severe disease. So what one thing that we could plausibly see is that although very, very large numbers of people get infected in the UK over the next couple of weeks, a very, very small percentage of those succumb to severe disease because of that longer lasting protection from cellular immunity. So we just don't know that the answer to that critical question, which is what portion of the huge case counts we're seeing at the moment will get into real trouble.
So in terms of what Sage are talking about, so we've had these minutes from Sage yesterday, Pippa Crower from the Mirror here, just summing up, almost certainly there are hundreds of thousands of new daily Omicron cases in England a day. Again, phenomenal in the worst possible way, given Omicron was only named 3 weeks ago and now it's sweeping through the nation. Without more restrictions, modelling indicates peak of at least 3,000 hospitalisations a day. Now, to put that in perspective for people watching or listening, hospitalisations peaked at around 4,000 a day, as far as I know, the worst part of our pandemic. In terms of what we've seen, no evidence Omicron less severe than Delta, UK researchers, Imperial College. But equally, and I know you shared this yourself the other day and I shared it, which was preliminary laboratory analyses indicating that Omicron significantly more transmissible than Delta, but less efficient replication of the lungs may suggest low severity. It seems to spread in the bronchus. Now, I know I'm not a biologist, but severity in humans is not determined only by virus replication, as Muj Chefik put this, if I pronounced the name right, but also by the host immune response. I guess I'm just wondering what you think about Sage, what Sage are saying. I mean, Sage deaths, again, this is grim stuff, but there's a graphs looking at a Sage model, various different estimates of where this could be in terms of deaths, depending on the severity. What do you think about Sage's, what models tell us? Now, Sage sometimes gets a lot of stick because sometimes people don't really understand what modelling is. They think it's a prediction. And previously, pessimistic models and reality haven't actually aligned. Freedom Day, I think, is one striking example of that. So what do you think about what the Sage modelling is telling us at the moment, and what you think about, you know, the Imperial College study and actually evidence coming out about if it's less severe?
Yeah, all great questions. I think obviously, as you've alluded to there, the key thing to remember with Sage is that this is a group of scientists who are putting out all sorts of slightly different models here. The Imperial papers were particularly interesting. But I'm personally very reluctant to lean too much on any individual paper, and that's particularly the case with these. And the death predictions that they put out, for example, I think are exceptionally worst case scenario. Like we're talking there about numbers that I would be absolutely astonished to see us come close to be honest, based on the wealth of research I've seen on this, because they're essentially assuming there that vaccines work very, very poorly at protecting against Omicron, particularly for those who haven't been boosted, like very, very poorly, to the extent that someone who'd had two doses of Pfizer, for example, and no booster, gets essentially zero protection from infection and only moderate protection against severe disease. And that's not in line with the evidence that we've seen from the early vaccine efficacy studies. So I think the Imperial's death numbers are sort of quite apocalyptic. And even, you know, it's the authors of that paper even have said that this was really, really should be seen as a worst case scenario and not something that is considered especially likely. In terms of the other models, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, and then I think it was yesterday or the day before, Warwick University put out their own models. I think these can tell us a bit more. So that's where we get those numbers of perhaps around 3,000 hospital admissions per day. The Warwick study was also particularly interesting because they actually did look at the question of what if there is some innate reduction in severity for Omicron. And if, for example, it's only around half as severe in terms of hospitalizations and deaths, then of course that could halve the number of people in hospital. So that could take us down substantially below what we saw last winter in terms of hospitalizations and deaths. The added tricky thing here is that, as I mentioned at the very start, we are going to see the number of people in hospital with Omicron over this winter actually include a lot of people who are not severely ill with COVID, but are catching it sort of in the community on their way to hospital or even in hospital, not necessarily becoming ill with it. So I look at this and I say, I think we can't rule out the chance that we end up with numbers of hospitalizations getting up to where we saw last winter. I don't think there's any solid basis on which to do that, but I do think it's well, I don't think it's implausible that we do see a small reduction in the severity of disease, and that could take us down more towards perhaps half as many hospitalizations as we saw last winter. Again, the number of COVID positive people we see in hospital may go above that, but the number of additional people going to hospital because of COVID may end up being somewhere around as half of what we saw last year. Again, that's based on a few of these different models and how I see things at the moment. But as we said, I'm not an epidemiological modeler, and all of these models are really trying to show the whole range of possibilities of things that might happen if we do various things, if the variant is as severe as various things, rather than saying here's what they think will happen.
I think you've already answered this in large part, but I'll just throw in Alan Ranger on Patreon asked why, apart from the age profile and seasonal difference in South Africa, why the UK are presumably more heavily vaccinated, they are more potentially at risk from a severe illness from Omicron than South Africa has shown to date. Also, Denmark is quite interesting because there's a very significant Omicron wave going on there. So actually data there as well as here is quite useful to compare. In their first 785 identified Omicron cases, 76% were fully vaccinated, 7.1% boosted, 4.3% prior infection, severity much lower than what was seen with Delta. 1.2% of cases were hospitalized, 0.3% went to ICU, no deaths. So is that looks like cause for optimism. And the other point is, when we talk about hospitalization, it's not taking into account the duration of hospitalization, isn't it? I mean, if we just throw everything into a hospitalization basket, there's a difference between being hospitalized for 2 days and 2 weeks in terms of the pressure on the National Health Service.
Yeah, all excellent points. So I'm just trying to remember what the first one was there. I'll do Denmark first.
Sorry, that was South Africa. UK, presumably more heavily vaccinated. Why, you know, potentially more at risk from a severe illness than Omicron than South Africa. I think you've largely answered that. But.
Yeah, and that's one, like, it's a tough one. Essentially, I don't think anyone is saying, this comes back to that, I think, misunderstanding of what we mean by talking about something being less severe. So I've not seen anyone saying that we would expect worse outcomes than South Africa in terms of severity. What we're saying is the UK has already had its big reduction in severity as a result of vaccination going into the Delta wave. So that's where we saw the percentage of cases ending up in hospital come down from around 10% to around 2%. So a very, very substantial reduction. So what we're saying is not that, oh, ignore South Africa, we think it's going to be just as bad as it has ever been over here. We're saying that what we need to happen in the UK is for the percentage of cases ending up in hospital to continue falling. So it was 10% last winter. It came down to 2% for Delta as a result of immunity. We're saying if immunity got us to 2% and it stays at 2%, then we're in a really, really bad situation coming into this winter, because 2% of a very large number could easily get as bad as last winter. What we're saying is we need that percentage of cases ending up in severe disease to fall further from 2% down to something like 0.5% or even less. And we're saying that it's not clear necessarily that boosters, for example, get us there, because the fact that Omicron is better able to evade part of our immunity is also a step in the other direction. So it may be that with boosters, we've been running to stand still. However, it absolutely may be that that's not the case, and that although Omicron makes it easier to become infected, we don't see that same backward step with protection against severe disease. So I think it does strike me as plausible that we will see a further reduction in the percentage of our cases ending up in hospital compared to what we had with Delta, because of that, those additional sort of bumps we've given to our immune system. In terms of the Denmark question, there are a few things to say about Denmark, because it feels like every day someone shares Danish data with me and they're using it to make completely opposite points. I've heard people talking about the Danish data showing that Omicron is actually more severe than Delta. I've seen others, as the comment made here, saying it's less severe. There's two things I think about that. The first is, again, with hospitalizations, we just need to be really careful at the moment, because even if a lot of people are going into hospital who tested positive for Omicron, that does not mean they have severe disease with COVID-19. So some people, for example, pointed to data from Denmark showing that a higher percentage of Omicron cases were being hospitalized. And that would have been my response there. Look, We don't actually know how many of these have severe disease, so we can't necessarily assume that means more severe. Your commenter here is saying the latest data from Denmark shows that a lower percentage are ending up in hospital, particularly in ICU. I think, first of all, I think that is something we should absolutely acknowledge, that that is what the data currently shows, and lots of people are keeping a very close eye on Denmark at the moment. Secondly, it's very, very early days, and that means the percentage of cases we would expect to have been hospitalised, we would almost expect a lower percentage of Omicron cases to be hospitalised than Delta, because it takes time for disease to develop to that level of severity. So it's at this early stage, we'd expect that percentage to be lower anyway. And that's especially the case when infections are rising as quickly as they are at the moment with Omicron, because it means for any given person who's been infected, less time has passed for them to have developed severe disease than we saw with the slower rising Delta wave. So there's a couple of things there. And then the third thing I would say, which is, you know, it's kind of a cop-out, but I think it's worth saying, is that it's just quite early days with this. And in South Africa, it took about 3 weeks of data to get a decent handle on severity. And in Denmark, just like in London, we're only about 4 or 5 days into the Omicron surge of cases. And again, it will probably take a couple more weeks before we get a good idea of it.
Just finally, you're a busy man. That data does not crunch itself, and it is Christmas. Again, I mean, I'm just interested in your thoughts, obviously, about the discussion about restrictions in this country. So, for example, if we look at Kit Yates, who's been on the show many times, brilliant modeler himself, a leading government advisor, he's quoting from the I paper, a leading government advisor has warned a circuit breaker lockdown after Christmas would be probably too late. And the most effective way to halt the rapid spread of Omicron is to act now. Sajid Javid, who is, of course, the health secretary, has refused to roll out further COVID curves before Christmas, which is 5 days, 6 days away. So kind of running out of time if they're going to do that. Many of us, of course, have made plans, but we all lived through December 2020, didn't we? And those plans obviously detonated quite quickly towards the end. What's your take on that whole debate about, because Omicron is going up, you know, that's the point. It's gone up like a, you know, a balloon very quickly. And as Chris Whitty has pointed out, actually it's going to peak much quicker than previous variants in that regard. So the consequences will hit it, because obviously there's a delay with of hospitalizations of about 2 weeks, of death up to 4 weeks. So, which is the whole point of when you act, actually, you know, it becomes too late quite quickly, because you suffer the consequences so long down the track of whenever you decide to act decisively. What's your take on that whole debate about restrictions and the impact they could have at this particular juncture?
It's really tricky, isn't it? So the only piece of sort of solid data I've seen on this was the Warwick model from a couple of days ago, which showed that it actually found that a lockdown or a series of measures implemented on Boxing Day rather than a week before Christmas would have relatively little impact on what peak hospitalizations ended up, for example, but that restrictions put in place then rather than in early to mid-January would make a big difference, which again, I think speaks to your point about how the delaying that extra couple of weeks can make a very big difference. It's just really tricky, because I mean, people have been right to point out that there are a couple of hints that this may not end up being as severe as we've seen before. It may be that, as we've been saying, because of these many layers of immunity that most people in the UK now have, that may mean we see a lot of cases but fewer people developing severe disease. And so I absolutely understand why some people look at that and say disrupting gatherings around Christmas is a big cost, and that people are not happy to pay that cost. On the flip side, of course, we certainly don't have enough information right now to say that things definitely will be less severe. We don't have enough information right now to say that the number of people with genuine severe COVID will not reach as high as it got last winter, or even half as high, which would equally be absolutely be something we'd want to avoid. So it really is tricky. I think, you know, the precautionary principle at this point says, okay, well, most of us at Christmas are only gathering with a small number of people over Christmas itself anyway, that with families, and that therefore a restriction on social gatherings bigger than that, or as people have said, after Christmas, after those most sort of sentimentally important gatherings have been had, it may not be an enormous price to pay to ensure that if the worst case scenario were to be realised, it wouldn't be as bad as it could look. But it is just tricky. This is ultimately it's a political decision. And the fact is, different scientists, different people looking at scientific data can perfectly well present different pieces of data which would lead to conclusions in different ways. So I think the idea that there is one neat answer here in the science is a little misleading. There is certainly a lot of information out there demonstrating the benefit of imposing some restrictions on gatherings at some point in the next couple of weeks. But again, we can't be 100% sure in terms of things like severity, which is why you see other people looking at this and saying that would be too much too soon. So I really am not in a position where I can sort of where I have a personal view on what should be done about restrictions, but I can understand people having different perspectives on this.
Just very lastly before I let you go, just because I think it's quite interesting. I think this, again, as you've emphasized, you're not an epidemiologist or virologist, but just as a statistician, this was a factor. Rosa Gilbert asked if I could ask you about the role the apparently shorter incubation period plays in Omicron becoming more transmissible, shorter doubling times, as opposed to higher R rate than Delta. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that is another thing that can actually work in different ways. I mean, the main way is that, of course, it could mean that people become infectious earlier than they would have otherwise have expected. You know, that in itself can just mean it's that much easier to spread because someone might not realize that they need to get a test until it's too late. It sort of compresses everything into a short amount of time. So yeah, I don't think that really changes any of the conclusions we draw here, but I think it tells us two things. One is it gives us essentially the reason that we have seen this thing spread quite as quickly as we have, or one of the reasons. But the other is that it makes it all the more important that for those people who are gathering over Christmas to take regular lateral flow tests, not just one, but take them almost every day and as close as possible to the time that you're going out to meet people, because it makes it all the more important to be checking regularly for whether we might have an infection that we don't know about.
John, that was absolutely brilliant. So thorough, very detailed, very nuanced, exactly what anyone who's followed you throughout this crisis would expect. And just to emphasize, by the way, what a class act, before we're joined by Ellie Mayer-Hagan, I'm just going to let John go in, joined by Ellie Mayer-Hagan from Class to talk about the politics of all this. But John, just to show what a class act he is, a lifeline, as I said, during this pandemic, the Times named him alongside others who've made this big contribution, but they were all white men. Now, what John has done on his Twitter feed is list incredible women who out throughout this pandemic have played a key role in talking about the data, the impacts, the sorts of restrictions we should have, many of whom have appeared on this show. So do follow, if you're not following John Byrne Murdoch on Twitter, please do so, and share that thread, which goes through lists brilliant women who've made a really big impact, who John has learned from, and so many of us who've talked about this pandemic throughout have also learned from as well. But John, you've been absolutely brilliant. Your work's been instrumental for the journalism of so many people across the British media and globally. So thank you for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks a lot, Owen.
Cheers, John. Take care. Bye-bye. Brilliant stuff. Now, before I bring in my brilliant friend, Ellie Mayer-Hagan, just housekeeping as ever. If you're watching live, do click on the YouTube link and do support the show on patreon.com/OwenJones84. We've got lots of documentaries to come. I'm going to do a thing on Patreon to ask people what documentaries we should do. So you will decide, as you've decided all of our documentaries up to this point. And press subscribe, use Super Chat to support the show as well. I'll read all the Super Chats at the end. And a special thanks to everyone who give a special thanks to those who've done it. And also subscribe to the podcast. That's enough for that. Let's be joined by Ellie Mayer-Hagan. Boo! Oh, you didn't expect that. You're looking down.
No, oh, yeah. I love it. I'm actually like, look at what I'm doing. This is neurotically wrapping my
Ellie, I've got to stop you. The audio. What's going on with your audio? What's happening? Very echoey.
You can't hear it. Oh really?
No, I can't hear you. It's just extremely echoey, and it sounds like you're in a bath or a tin. It sounds like Ellie's in a tin.
Is that better?
Just say a load of stuff and see what happens.
I don't know what to say.
Do you want to take your headphones out? Is that annoying?
Okay, let's try it. How about that?
Go and speak now.
Is that better?
Well, no, now I can hear myself. Oh, hold on. So speak again.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
I think so. I'm just going to see what people think. I'm going to ask you a question and I'm going to see what people think about the audio and then we'll work it out. We'll work it out, Ellie. We'll work this out. Someone says it's the headphone mic. It's the headphone mic that's the problem. But have you now disconnected the headphone?
No, let me try again.
I like this. We're doing, by the way, we will talk about the politics of this, I promise you. We're crowdsourcing because people are asking, check your mic input on Zoom, but you're not on Zoom. So it's the headphone mic, basically. Go on, speak again.
Well, I don't have headphones in now.
No, you don't. Do you know what? I think that's fine. Ellie, right, let's just start, shall we? In terms of, I'm just going to start with a little...
When my husband gets back, I'll switch headphones with him.
Yeah, maybe do that, because you are a bit tinny. So, here's what the polling says. Net support for shutting pubs and restaurants. 30%. This was a YouGov poll done on the 14th to the 15th of December, so this week. 30% support shutting pubs and restaurants. 60% oppose. Shut non-essential shops. 26% support that. 65% oppose. Ban household mixing indoors. 28% support. 62% oppose. Now, during this whole crisis, the public has actually supported lockdown in massive numbers and actually has been far more committed to those measures than the government. They've often thought the government's too slow. They've supported measures quicker and more drastically than the government's prepared to take. On these figures, that has evaporated.
Yes. Are you asking me to comment on that? What I think of that?
That's the basic thing with your slightly tinny voice.
So David Kynaston, who you know, wrote a book called Austerity Britain, where he it was actually written before the Cameron government, and he actually looked back at previous periods in our national history where we've had to have austerity, or there's been a political choice to impose austerity, and he found that there's two reasons why people support it. The first is that it's necessary, they see it as necessary. And the second is that they see it as done in a way that's fair. And I would say something similar applies here, right? I think, especially in the first lockdown, I think there was a sense of this is necessary and we're all kind of in it together. It's like a national effort. But I think, since mid-July, we've basically been living normal lives. We're all vaccinated. It's a sort of quite a mad experience to be vaccinated twice in a year. It doesn't happen to adults, really, unless you're traveling to sort of certain countries.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST. Code ACAST.
So there was definitely this sense of we've been through the worst of it. And now, we can kind of move on and sort of repair. And I think actually what's going on now is that now we're being seen to be asked to do all of that all over again, even though now we're getting vaccinated for the third time, that we kind of went back to normal and now we have to go back again. I think people are frustrated by that. I think that the social costs of lockdown have mounted and mounted and mounted. You can't keep doing it forever because every time you do, it sort of destroys things a little bit. And all of that's happened at the same time as it's been revealed through a series of stories over a couple of weeks that all of the people who told us we had to go into lockdown were actually not obeying the rules themselves. So I think that means that the political basis for lockdown, the basis of people consented to it, I think has been destroyed. So now most people don't want to do it anymore, I think.
I've turned down your volume, by the way, not to silence you, but I think that might have helped. I think so. do you think this is how I see it? Basically, there was a social contract. Now, originally, people supported lockdown at the beginning of the crisis. And let's bear in mind, lockdown is an extreme measure. Let's just be clear about that. I mean, in the pre-COVID-19 world, the idea that the government would, by legal force, ban you from seeing your friends and family, ban you from hugging, ban you from having sex, essentially, unless you're with a long-term partner, ban you from going to have a pint, all of these things would seem completely ludicrous. The whole world, as we know it, completely turned upside down, which is, of course, what happened. But what happened in March is people were aware of a very, very serious virus, which, if not contained, would overwhelm our National Health Service, so it would be unable to function and provide basic services to people who needed it, causing mass death and social devastation. That's why we locked down, to protect the National Health Service. Now, as time went on, vaccination became seen as the obvious way out. Mass vaccination, which began a year ago. And then there was a sentence last December onwards of, oh no, here we go again. But there is light at the end of the tunnel. We all get vaccinated, we'll be protected. The virus's threat will diminish in terms of serious illness, hospitalization, the potential for the NHS being overwhelmed, and death. Now we've had mass vaccination and we're now talking about locking down again. The Netherlands already has. That's when the social contract begins to erode. Plus, the government have been seen to violate the very rules they themselves have enforced. So that is the problem, isn't it? The problem we have now is people just think this will never end. And actually, a lot of the anti-lockdown is written there. We told you it would never end. We never end. I mean, obviously, you know, the issue is we have a virus which is resistant to the vaccines. Now, that doesn't, I mean, some people on the left are now, this is what I'm asking about, because I mean, I don't know how they're not maybe that influential, but actually they will be more influential now, given the polling, that we just need to stop this. We need to stop lockdowns. We can't keep shutting down society. We've got to find a way of making this virus, of living with this virus. That means increasing statutory sick pay, which is amongst the lowest in the Western world. It means economic support, so people can self-isolate when they're ill. It doesn't wish away a question which can't be wished away, which is, how do you stop the National Health Service potentially being overwhelmed with so many admissions it can't cope and can't look after people with life-threatening conditions? So that's the problem, isn't it? It's people. That's why people are ground down, but reality hasn't just gone.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when we talk about the left, and maybe you could even say the sort of broader spectrum of progressive views in this country, I think there's been a sense that people on the left and people who are progressive, or at least opposed to this government, have maybe reacted in a bit of a knee-jerk way as each development has happened. And the result of that is that we haven't sort of coalesced around a sort of viewpoint, and maybe our knee-jerk reactions have led us to some misjudgments, and have maybe we've missed some opportunities maybe. And I think now there is this feeling amongst some people on the left of, we need to stop like demanding lockdowns all the time. I mean, I'm not sure to what extent that really is a blanket feeling on the left anyway, but I mean, the demanding of lockdowns, I mean. But there is definitely this feeling of, we need to stop demanding lockdowns all the time, and we actually need to start transforming society in a permanent way, so that we can actually, like, in the same way as we have with, like, diseases like HIV, right? Like, you know, HIV has killed millions and millions of people, and far too late, if you ask me, but eventually, societies have changed the way that we work in order to keep people safe. You know, not only have we developed new therapeutics and so on, but we've like massive public health campaigns, free condoms, you know, that kind of thing. Needle exchange, you know, all of this kind of thing. And so we need something like that for COVID, which I think would look like, as you say, much better sick pay. I think Victoria in Australia is a really good example of this. They you get 2 years full pay nearly if you're sick in Victoria, better big ventilation program, you know, transforming the NHS from not being just the kind of just about managing health service, but one that is actually like works really well all the time and can cope with stuff like this. Those are the solutions that people want. And I think the problem that I have is exactly what you just mentioned, which is that none of that can be done in the next 2 weeks. And even if it could be done, the fruits of that will not be felt in time to deal with the acute problem that we have right now, which is all of that stuff that John, your previous guest, was just talking about. You know, yes, we don't have enough information. And if it transpires that we don't need a lockdown, I'll be the first to be very happy about that, because like most people, I hate them. I don't want to have another one. But I think the question that we really need to be asking here is, are we willing to let the NHS collapse or aren't we? You know, that is the question. Lots of people on the left have said to me, but lockdowns are so destructive and they're so bad for our civil liberties. And I'm like, okay, so are you willing to risk the NHS collapsing to protect our civil liberties? Like, because that's the argument. That is the only argument that we have to have. Because if some of those SAGE figures are right, or even as John said, if they're half right, then the NHS is in a lot of trouble. And it's already, and you've got to remember, it's in a worse state now than it was at the beginning of the pandemic as well. It's already in a terrible, terrible state. I don't know if any of your viewers have used it lately, but let me tell you, it's not good. Go on.
Well, no, it's just interesting because, it's what you alluded to partly, that, you know, often those such as ourselves are construed as...
Can I have your headphones?
Oh, hello. Wait a minute. I'll just mute you while you do that. But I'll mute you while you get the headphones. Yeah, we're kind of caricatured as lockdown fetishists, fapping away to lockdown. Sorry about the graphic image. And yet, actually, just FYI, I hate lockdown. I thought it was a miserable experience. Some people got something out of it. Life's quieter. We can get to explore various parts of our lives we couldn't before. I hated every moment of it, and I'm privileged. I'm a middle-class professional who can work at home. I'm not amongst working-class people driven to unsafe workplaces on poverty levels or statutory sick pay that force them to choose between whether or not they can look after their kids, their families, or whether they stop the spread of a deadly virus that threatens to overwhelm the National Health Service. The fact is, though, it was an evil, a terrible evil, but it was up against a greater evil. And the question with that equation is, what becomes the greater evil? And for my own view is, I supported so-called Freedom Day, perhaps a bit controversial, because my view was that by then, lockdown was a greater evil than the threat it was up against. And you do have to manage risk to some degree. Now, at the same time, if we look at our current situation, there is no lockdown, and yet people are making rational decisions to avoid social contact. We know that because the statistics about pubs, bars, restaurants, cinemas, theatres collapsing, meaning those sectors need government support they're not getting at the moment. Public transport figures have massively gone down. People, you know, I had lots of parties this weekend, like a big old party gay I am. They've all evaporated because people have made the rational decisions to cancel them. So we've ended up in a situation with a kind of semi-lockdown, basically, through personal choice. I mean, this is why the anti-lockdown rhetoric doesn't work, because you end up with a de facto semi-lockdown, but without any economic support for the sectors who are actually being affected. Have you put new headphones in? What's happened?
My husband tells me that it's because I'm too loud and it's not the headphones.
Oh, people have suggested that in the comments as well. But anyway, carry on. No, they said...
I am quite loud. It has been said. I have got a loud voice.
So am I. I turned down your volume though. But anyway, but you sound great.
I don't think it necessarily should be a choice between... Like, I don't think we should have to lock down in order to support those sectors. I think that the government should be giving them support now anyway, because I guess my whole point with this thing is we should actually deal with the realities of the situation rather than hypotheticals. And the reality of the situation is that, you know, sectors like the arts, like entertainment, like hospitality are really, really suffering now. So regardless of what happens with the lockdown, they need help. So I think that's the first thing to say about that. And I think also, you know, you've got to remember how many people like have to continue working even when there's a lockdown as well. And, you know, they deserve sort of help and support, like sick pay, isolation payments, and also like better conditions at work, which I think basically means introducing union neutrality agreements so that unions can go into workplaces and advocate for people as they should. But I think like, for me, the question here that I'm like, because you invited me on because I sort of did a Twitter thread about it that got loads of angry responses, but that's pretty par for the course with me, to be honest. Whatever I say, I could say like, yeah, I could be like, you know, it's a nice day, and I'd be like, ah! Anyway, so whatever. But like, but I guess all of the people that I've heard oppose lockdown from a left perspective, none have actually been able to give me an answer about what are we going to do about the NHS then in the next 3 weeks. And I, to be honest, to be clear with you, I'm not even saying that we should have a lockdown. I just want to know the answer to that question. I just want to know, like, if we're not going to have a lockdown, what are we going to do about that? And if we don't know what else we're going to do about that, then the NHS might well become overwhelmed, and then there won't be a healthcare system.
So, and I mean, I'm like you.
Go on.
No, I was just saying. No, I can't interrupt you there. So, no, I'm a COVID pragmatist, which is just that's always what I was. Which was, what's the data say? How do we prevent the NHS from being overwhelmed? As long as I'm satisfied on both those counts, the data is pointing in a direction which is manageable. The NHS won't be overwhelmed. Then I'm like, we don't need further restrictions. If it is the other direction, then obviously my view changes. I mean, I am interested in terms of the politics of this further, because it's interesting at the moment, the government, I mean, we do have a problem, which is, you know, a government which doesn't have public trust in it during a public health emergency is not actually very good for any of us, because people cease to take the, you know, look, both of us in normal times, we like people to defy authority, fight the government, fight the regime. But on a public health emergency, you do need, when, like in a war, a national emergency, you need some level of trust with what the government is saying on that particular issue, in order for society to function and not suffer the terrible consequences of that pandemic. That obviously has been chronically undermined. What I do think is interesting, Boris Johnson, a man we both regard as a bigot, a charlatan, a liar, someone who is completely unfit for public office, whatever you think about his ever-shifting ideology. What is interesting is the people gunning for him, and we see this with the resignation of Sir Frost yesterday, is actually they think two things. They think he's too left-wing on the economy. That's what the Tory backbenchers who are gunning for Boris Johnson currently think at the moment. They only backed him in the first place because they thought he was the uniquely best-placed antidote to Farageism and Corbynism, which they saw was intertwined, because the better the Brexit Party did, the more likely they saw Corbyn becoming Prime Minister. But also, I just lost my train of thought. What was I saying there? Wait a minute. Hold on. Yes, they think he's too hardline on the pandemic. So they think he's too left-wing on the economy, and they think he's too hardline on the pandemic. Not something we both think, Ellie. We think the opposite. We think, obviously, he's an economically on the right, and we also think he's not dealt with the pandemic properly, with terrible human consequences. But that is what they're going for him for. That's what this rebellion is all about against Boris Johnson at the moment.
I mean, of all of the things to rebel against Boris Johnson for, I mean, I don't even know where to begin with that. But like, yeah, I think as much as I understand that people's desire to call for his head on a platter, metaphorically, at the moment, I
to avoid Ellie getting arrested there. Carry on.
Yeah, I do actually think that all of the people who are like would be lined up to replace him would be worse. And I think that is something worth thinking about. I think, you know, like Charles Bukowski once said, if you're going to destroy something, you better have something better to replace it with. And it's not clear to me that there is something better. I mean, it's astonishing for me to hear myself say that. I mean, that just shows how bad things are in our politics, that there is no one, like Boris Johnson is probably the best option that we have of the available options right now. That is really awful.
Rishi Sunak, for example, who is amongst obviously the favourites to take over, and Rishi Sunak was one of the leaders against restrictions throughout the crisis, particularly actually last autumn to winter, when he invited COVID sceptics to Number 10 in a successful effort to convince Boris Johnson not to impose a circuit breaker, which then was delayed and became the belated November lockdown, the kind of baby lockdown in all the lockdowns.
Yeah, and I think as well, he's, I think we had more austerity measures with Rishi Sunak. And I can't think of anything worse right now than austerity, given the sort of terrible state that our public sector is in. You know, it's not just the NHS, it's also teachers have had a really terrible time. Local authorities have been, you know, having a really difficult time, and they've already cut to the bone. So I think we'd see more austerity with him, and I think that would be absolutely disastrous in every sort of every possible metric. I think that would be politically, economically, socially, would be absolutely disastrous. You know, and then the other one is Liz Truss. I mean, that would be a terrible idea. I mean, I don't even know where to begin with that.
That is a disgrace! For those who haven't watched the clip, Liz Truss was talking about the excessive importing of cheese into Britain.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, like, but what you said earlier, just before you got on to Boris Johnson, is like, we are in a position at the moment, and I guess I wanted to talk about this as well. We are in a position at the moment where people largely don't want a lockdown, and they kind of hate the government, and they hate the government for making them lock down. And that is, like, obviously not an ideal position for us to be in, for anyone to be in. And what I think a lot of people have said to me when I've asked them this question about, you know, what is your plan for the NHS in the next 2-3 weeks if it's not locking down? How do we solve that then? They often say to me, you know, we need to not focus on lockdowns. We need to actually start talking about long-term measures. That is one of the goals that we have missed in this whole process. And I agree with that, but I think actually now is the perfect time that we can do that, because we can say, look, this lockdown is now necessary because of all of these things that haven't been done. So we need to actually start implementing all of these measures now, like sick pay, like ventilation and so on, so we never have to do this again, because we can't keep going through this destructive cycle of lockdown and release. So I actually think this is quite a good moment for us to actually, well, not a good moment, I don't know what the word is. You know what I mean by good, not good.
An opportune moment, maybe.
Exactly, yeah, an opportune moment to sort of actually make an intervention and say, you're sick of this, I'm sick of this, let's try and do something different, you know. And I think that's what we need to do. But by sort of saying that's what we need to do and then arguing against the lockdown, I'm like, fine, let's not have lockdown then, but like, let's discuss what we're going to do then, given what the next 2-3 weeks look like. That's I think my challenge to people who are against another lockdown, you know, who aren't, like, you know, people who go on anti-vax protests and stuff. My challenge to those people is, what do you want to do about the next 2 or 3 weeks then? Do you want to just leave it to chance and hope for the best? Because my dad's been rushed into hospital twice this year already, and I'd prefer that didn't happen. But you may feel differently. Okay, maybe you want to risk it, fine. But, like, not everybody has the luxury of that being an abstract thing that they get to gamble with.
It's a very, very important point to inject into this. Just in terms of a couple of things, in terms of Labour, now at the moment, a lot of Starmer's crew in a kind of triumphalist mode, because Labour have pulled ahead in the polls. Now, believe it or not, despite some of the angry ultra-Starmer people on Twitter who spend their angry centrist dad days screaming at me, much to the sometimes derision of some on the left, I'm just, as well as a socialist, I'm a Labour guy. I joined the Labour Party when I was 15. I voted for Labour under every single leader from Blair onwards, national and local elections. That's going to annoy a lot of people. It does annoy a lot of people when I say that, but that is true. And I've been cursed for something I've done terrible in another life, for having people who were voting Liberal Democrat 2 years ago denouncing me for my anti-Labour treachery and demanding I'm driven from the Labour Party for not worshipping at the shrine of Sir Keir Starmer. But nonetheless, they're in a triumphalist mode, not because they've done anything, they haven't, but because the Tories have essentially doused themselves in petrol and set themselves on fire. And people now think, oh, well, you can't criticise Labour because, look, they're doing, well, tough, suck it up. What they should have done is use their leverage. Do you not agree with this? I wrote about this last week. Because, and you tweeted this last week, because I shared it, and you got some of these angry people screaming at you in your mentions.
Don't read it.
Don't read. Yeah, maybe it's good for everyone's sanity. Do not read. They are the most tedious people. Look, I get screamed at by all sorts of people. Anti-trans
extremists. I mean, they are tedious, to be fair. Far-right extremists and so on. I'm not comparing Starmer people to far-right people. I'm just saying they're just tedious people to yell at. They're generally just very, very boring, tedious people.
There's many different flavours of tedious. Not one political faction has a monopoly on being tedious.
That is true, and there are people on the left. People think I'm tedious, so, you know, have some self-reflection, Erin. But what they could have done, look, the Tories have they've obliterated their majority on the issue of COVID. And what Labour could have done is say, we will back your measures, your very limited measures anyway, vaccine passports, which I'm sceptical about, by the way, but they only, research suggests, going to reduce community transmission by 1% to 5%. And that was before Omicron, negligible, really. What Labour should have said is, if you want us to back you, hike statutory sick pay to a livable degree, give economic support to these sectors which were affected, give a commitment on furlough if sections of the economy do have to be locked down, ventilation, a mass ventilation program in schools and workplaces. They didn't need these things. They just said, oh, we'll just back you, whatever.
Yeah, well, I think they've got this. Just to say as well, I'm actually not in favour of vaccine passports, because I think that in order to make them effective, you have to make them so strict that then it actually does become like a bit of an infringement on one's civil liberties.
Just to correct myself, though, they're COVID passports, just so people don't yell at me. They're COVID passports, so it's either proof of vaccination and or that you have recently had an infection. Oh, no, you've tested negative. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's pointless because, I mean, you got COVID, didn't you, from an event where you had to have a negative lateral flow test again.
Yeah, turns out going to an all-night gay rave with your top off is fertile grounds to get COVID.
But also fertile ground for some good fun as well.
Yeah, wasn't it? I wrote those worth it because people will yell at me. Carry on.
But anyway, Keir Starmer. Yes, I think like they've become captured by this idea that they can't get political, and that they need to appeal to people's sense of patriotism. And I don't know where they're getting that idea from, because I have done lots of research into public attitudes, and what I found is that people, when you talk about British values, that doesn't tend to move people. People are either quite cynical, they have an idea of what British values are and they're quite cynical about them, or they're just like, I don't even know what that means. So I don't know, and probably they're going to focus groups and they're asking people about patriotism and they're getting answers, and then they're like, oh, people really care about patriotism. I think, but, you know, obviously people are going to talk about the issues that you ask them to talk about. It doesn't necessarily mean that, like, it's the most important issue to them. And I think they're worried about being seen to play politics. But we weren't asking them to say to the Conservatives, you know, we'll back these measures if you give my mate a seat in the House of Lords. Like, this is not politics. This is about, well, I mean, in that definition of it, this is actually about people's lives. Like, and what is the point of politics if you don't improve people's lives? And I don't know who they're speaking to, because I can tell you that most people that I know and that I've like heard of, like, you know, in my research, would be very, very in favour of improvement in statutory sick pay, because either it affects them directly or it affects someone that they know directly, the crummy sick pay that we currently have. And polling bears that out, that people are really in favour of it. So I think that actually Labour using some leverage to push for that would have shown that it understands the reality of most people's lives. But also it would have, as a friend of mine put it, it would have forced the Tories to look the voters in the eye and say, no, we'd rather sabotage our own measures than give you proper sick pay. And actually, I think we should be forcing that. We should be forcing the Tories to actually sort of reveal how little they care about the people that they're supposed to represent. And I think this, even if it wouldn't have resulted in sick pay, I think it would have at least demonstrated to the public that, like, it is a possibility and they don't want to do it for their own political reasons rather than because it can't be done.
Ellie, I want to ask you something finally, which is completely a segue from all of this, but I do want to bring it up, which is the election in Chile today, which...
Oh, God, I haven't followed that at all.
No, I didn't. Do you know what? You don't need to. You don't know. It doesn't matter. Honestly, seriously, I was going to ask you a general kind of. No, I'm just. I just wanted to bring it up because for me, so just to be people aware. Basically, there's a presidential election in Chile today. Gabriel Boric is the left candidate, and he's up against a far right Pinochet stooge, who basically is a Bolsonaro type. That is high stakes. A socialist against a far right extremist. No, I just because I mean for me, I mean you know lots of people involved in solidarity struggles with Latin America. I mean, I know Colombia is something you've been particularly passionate about, and the human rights situation there. There's an election coming up in Colombia where there's a left candidate with a potential chance of winning, which is unprecedented in the modern history of Colombia. No, I just think for me, I just think it's really interesting because Chile is where it all began, neoliberalism. And this is what Gabriel Boric, the socialist candidate, said. He said, you know, Chile was the birthplace of neoliberalism and now it will be its graveyard. Which is, you know, kind of put chills down my spine. And for me, you know, it has a certain emotional significance because my parents took in Chilean refugees, like a lot of socialists in South Yorkshire in the 1970s. And one family they took in, the mother, mother and two kids, my parents brought in before I was born, before people start. I was born in 1984, okay? Geriatric millennial. But no, I mean, she was traumatized. She actually ended up taking her own life in Chile, in Sheffield. And that caused a huge trauma, I know, in the Chilean diaspora at the time. And I've had many British Chileans come up to me and talk to me about that woman who died. I actually tracked down the kids who lived with my parents in Chile. I spoke to them a couple of years ago. On the phone, which was emotional. And it was just because, you know, Chile was, you know, Pinochet overthrew democratically elected President Salvador Allende. It was the first 9/11, September the 11th, 1973. Around 3,000 people died, which is the same as 9/11, much smaller population. This was the testing ground of neoliberalism. We've seen these big student protests and movements. We'll find out the election's taking place now. If your people are listening back, or we might know or already know the result. Let's hope it's not bleak. But no, I'll just say generally, it's do you not think it's quite emotional given, you know, we look at these great struggles in Latin America where there is actually, you know, we've seen the rise of the left. There was actually a bit of a reversal, not least for the likes of Bolsonaro. Lula's ahead of the polls. Various left candidates have won elections across Latin America recently. No, I just think there's something quite emotional anyway about Chile and you know, the significance it has for the left, that if this is, you know, finally nearly half a century after that coup, finally justice, and we can all dance on Pinochet's grave.
Well, yeah, I think Noam Chomsky once said that the Latin American working class is the hope of the world. And I think that's like really true. And actually, when I was in Colombia, I think that was one of the things that really struck me, was like a very politicized, organized working class that I hadn't come across before in this country. And it was just very different to this country in a way that I found like completely inspiring. I think, you know, to sort of, I think for me, like one of the reasons I got really into Colombian politics, is because I think like showing solidarity with the sort of Latin American working class to me is quite important because of everything that I think we in this country can learn from what they've done. And I think, you know, I think one of the big lessons I've learned in politics in the last couple of years is the importance of events. You know, so for example, I remember after seeing a friend of ours, or I won't name because I'm not sure if he wants me to name, but after the 2019 general election was lost, and he was like, you know, it's going to be rubbish for a bit, but then events will overtake things. And then life will just move on to the next event. And I think that's something that Labour should think about, by the way, is that, like, yes, they might have good polling now because of the Tories setting themselves on fire, but, like, events will change things. And I think similarly, you see that with Latin America, you know, how you had the kind of rise and fall of the pink tide, and it looked like kind of right-wing authoritarian populism was going to take over various Latin American countries. But then events got in the way and then things happened. You know, I think Lula and in Brazil is another example of that. So, yeah, I think I have a lot of hope when it comes to Latin America. I constantly feel inspired by what happens there. And I think, you know, people in this country that want to agitate for a better world can learn from the people there who have achieved extraordinary things, often in the most extreme conditions, and showing a level of courage that I couldn't even fathom. So yeah, I mean, I really hope that it goes the way that we all hope, basically, is what I can say about that.
Well, I hope
they deserve it as well. They will really deserve this.
Yeah, fingers crossed it does go well. And if it does, we'll do a show with people live from Chile. If it doesn't, I'll be too miserable to talk about it, so we won't. But Ellie, seriously, thank you so much for joining us at very short notice.
Sorry about my sound or my loud voice.
People actually have defended you in the comments going, can people stop saying she sounds fine? Stop saying she's too loud.
Yeah, my mother always did used to say to me that I was too loud. So there you go, at least it makes me feel nostalgic.
Yeah, no one's ever accused me of being too loud. They have. People say it all the time. That was great though, Ellie. When are you off? Are you going to Wales for Christmas? I can't even remember.
Well, we have a plan to go, but but on the 27th, so obviously we might be in lockdown. If you know, listening to what John said, if the push is currently for Boxing Day, then no. So I really hope so, but I guess events will dictate.
Well, fingers crossed. I'll see you soon. Lots of love. Everything will be fine. But seriously, that was great. Thanks. And people saying here, Ellie was swell.
Thanks. Nice to have nice feedback. It's so rare.
You get loads of nice feedback. Thanks, Ellie. You sounded great. Thank you, Ellie. These are just reading out.
I just want to mitigate, say one thing to mitigate, which is I went for a freezing cold swim before I did this, hence the bad hair. And I was like shivering all the way through this interview. So that if I seemed a bit jittery, that was why.
No, you didn't at all. As Stephen says, Ellie, it's not your voice, which is lovely. It's the microphone setup. Okay, the microphone has got a bit of stick, but you said great things. That's what matters.
I need to invest in a microphone like you.
And for the podcast, we'll just sort out the sound, so it's fine. All right, lots of love. Speak to you soon. Bye. Bye then. Oh, God. Oh, I haven't ejected you. Sorry, normally you have a virginity. Wow, that was... She just walked out. She left. Cheers, everyone. Thanks for that. So before we leave, what am I going to say? Oh, I'm going to go through some super chats quickly. Because I'm sorry about the show. We didn't do it at midday just because of COVID. People keep getting ill. So many people I know have COVID. Obviously, my esteemed comrade, Michael Walker. He's got the bug. Joss McDonald. He used to work for Jeremy Corbyn. Very good friend of mine. He's just announced on Twitter. I hope he doesn't mind me. I hope people don't mind me just reading out their COVID status. He did tweet about it, so probably not. Every day, just my WhatsApps. It is an absolute bloodbath going on, particularly in London at the moment. Lots of people are getting infected, obviously, on a daily basis, which we can see from the official statistics, which obviously are only a fraction of the actual numbers of people who are getting Omicron at the moment, which is obviously running rampant. We don't know yet, as we've gone through, we don't know exactly yet how bad that is and what the consequences will be. But I do hope that very detailed run through at the beginning of the show, the first half of the show with John, answered a lot of questions. Now, he's very clear, there's a lot of unknowns, to quote Donald Rumsfeld, known unknowns. Don't quote Donald Rumsfeld or other such war criminals on a regular basis. Obviously, we will keep abreast of that on this particular show, notwithstanding my thriving social life at the moment. In terms of, I should just quickly probably say as well, because my plan is to go, I said this last time, to go to Barcelona for the whole of January to finish my book, which is now 3 years overdue. So I should really finish that book. The Alternative and How We Build It, a cheerful book. It's for my own well-being, if nothing else. I will still do the show from January, but just so you know, I keep saying the reason we've been less active is because I just need to finish the book, which is what I've been working on. But we will throw everything at the video channel when that's done, which is great. We've got loads of documentaries, which you support through Super Chat, such as Tad Campwell. He says, happy holes, Owen. Apologies for my attempts to condense convoluted ideas into Super Chats with questionable readability and grammar. Writing is hard. Tad, your questions are always consistently brilliant, by the way. And I agree with you. I hate writing, personally. I literally loathe writing. I know that's unfortunate given my job, but it is hard. Just a special thanks to David Barata, to Salvador Loret Filler, who says only if enough pressure is applied by business, because lockdown light means negatives for the working public, no insurers needing to pay out. Very good point. Kieran Buckley as well. If I've missed anyone, I'll go through them in the next show. As I've said, I am hoping to do a show on Chile. That does depend on the presidential results. I'm just not going to do a show if the far-right candidate wins, because I'm going to be so miserable about it. Not to censor myself, which what matters about Chile, but what would be the point in doing a show about such utter misery? So let's hope Gabriel pulls through. I have hope. I have belief in the people of Chile. It's very close. The polling suggested Boric had the edge, but there was some narrowing of the polls. The far-right candidate did come top in the first round, let's not forget. But we will do a show with people from Chile if it's the result I want. Sorry, just to be honest about it. So fingers crossed there. And there are lots of presidential elections, lots of big elections coming up across Latin America. Colombia, as I've mentioned, next year, a left candidate with a good chance. Brazil, Lula, doing exceptionally well in the polls at the moment against Bolsonaro. Lots of people ask, though, what dirty tricks are the Brazilian establishment going to pull? Will they put up another candidate other than Bolsonaro, because he's just so disastrously unpopular now? There's lots of question marks. We've seen a spate of elections in which the left have generally done well in Latin America. So in a world of despair and gloom, there is some hope in Latin America, and that is often erased because there's hundreds of millions of people who live in Latin America, and there is much we can learn from in terms of those political projects. Stephen Calder, all the best with your new book. Thanks, Stephen. I will finish it, and it will come out next autumn. That's the plan. So it'll be a nice, cheerful book. I'll leave it there. Do, as I've said, support us on patreon.com/OwenJones84 so we can keep the podcast, the documentaries, and the show on the road. Obviously, I am just one person amongst this whole team. Do press like, that helps the algorithm on YouTube, and subscribe and listen to the podcast. We'll sort out Ellie's audio for that for a start. Cheers, everyone, though. Honestly, it's been a real pleasure. We do have more shows this year, but thanks for all of us. You've helped me get through this year. It's not been the best year, let's be honest. Neither was 2020. But having you lot around has certainly made my life less gloomy and miserable than it currently otherwise would have been. And I hope we've all been a nice community, generally as a channel, and you've all got a lot out of it as well. Anyway, lots of love. Keep fighting. Stay safe. Don't give up. Be full of optimism. And I'll see you hopefully during the week for a result for a show about Chile, if it goes the right way. Lots of love. Take care, everyone. Thanks for listening, everyone. I hope you found that informative, educational, interesting, and I certainly did. Do support us on Patreon to keep the show on the road, /OwenJones84. Leave us some stars, that'd be nice. Spread the word. And I look forward to speaking to you soon.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.